opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Good morning and welcome to this March 21st, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access that later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. Every Wednesday morning, we gather here to chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Today's theme is strong women. Jasmine Darznik is here with me with her biographical novel about Iranian poet Farouk. She's going to pronounce it better than I am for me this morning. The book is Song of a Captive Bird. And in the second half, Tara Westover is sharing her memoir, Educated. Jasmine Darznik was born in Tehran, Iran, and moved to America when she was 5 years old. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Good Daughter, a memoir of my mother's hidden life. Her work has been published in 13 countries and recognized by the Steinbeck Fellows Program, the Corporation of Yaddo, and others. Her stories and essays have been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and elsewhere. She holds an MFA in fiction from Bennington College and a PhD in English from Princeton. Now a professor of literature and creative writing at California College of the Arts, she's here this morning to discuss her first novel, Song of a Captive Bird. It's published by Ballantine Books. Jasmine, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Good to be here. Yeah, thanks for coming on. So it feels like in many ways, though your novel is utterly different story and an utterly different woman, there's a lot of resonance, it felt like, between your novel and your memoir. I don't know if you felt like that. But.
Right. Well, the novel really grew out of the memoir. I had written a memoir about my mother's life, and she's roughly the same age as Farouk would have been, both born in Tehran in the mid-30s, and so that was a territory I knew really well from having told my mom's story, and there were also certain themes that were similar. My mom also had been married very young, in her case when she was 13, and she had given up a child, so those were experiences that I knew well and a time I knew really well, and so in some ways it's a companion book, you might even think.
Yeah, right, right. So I'm going to let you take us into it for readers that haven't yet picked it up and talk about the poet, talk about what inspired you and kind of her story in Iran.
Sure. So my family and I had come from Iran in the late 1970s, in 1978, and my mom had smuggled out a book of Farouk's poems when we were leaving Iran. It was a really hasty kind of departure, but she took her favorite book, as I would if I were, you know, if I were hastily packing. I think I'd still have the presence of mind to take a cherished book or two. And so I had grown up with that book on the shelf. It was one of the very few books my mom had in our home. And Farouk had always fascinated me for years and years and years. I didn't read her poetry until I went to university, but I knew of her mystique and her reputation. She's one of the most, if not the most, famous woman in Iranian history, certainly in the 20th century. So she kind of hooked herself into me, and as I began to read more about her, her life was so fascinating, and it was taking place at this really complicated time in Iran's history. But nobody outside of Iran knew about her, so I felt like it was just such an extraordinary story of this woman who'd married very young. She'd made tremendous sacrifices. She became eventually Iran's best-known woman poet and one of the best poets altogether of all time, and Iran has no shortage of great poets, you know. So the book really grew out of my fascination with her and also a desire to share the story of this woman that I think a lot of people couldn't even imagine that a woman like Farouk had ever existed in Iran. So a desire to share her story and to, you know, perhaps enrich people's understanding of what Iran and Iran's women are.
Yeah. Do you feel like the subject matter sort of finds you, or do you feel like you're seeking it out? Like, do you feel like your mother and Farouk were sort of, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a strange question, but I'm wondering kind of what their, it sounds like their hook was in you early on. And I'm just wondering, like, did you always feel compelled to write about these women, or did you feel like, I don't know. Am I making sense?
No, you do make sense. I mean, I think it's almost often the case that the book chooses you.
Yeah, right.
In the case of my memoir, a lot of writers will write autobiographical stories, whether they're doing it in memoir or in fiction on the first book, and that kind of feels like the story that your life gave you.
And yeah,
a lot
right,
of people
right.
feel this great desire to share that and to make a book out of it. And I definitely had that feeling. And in my mom's case, her story was really one that I had not seen told anywhere. And so I really I felt this really keen passion to tell it. And with Furuh also, I feel she chose me as much or more than I chose her. And she was, you know, in some ways it was a really challenging project because it's, as you can imagine, taking on the life of the most iconic woman in Iranian history could pose, you know, a few challenges and, you know, might make you quake in your knees a little bit. So if I had been wiser or if I had maybe more choice in it, but I was really pushed forward by my curiosity, you might even say my obsession, and there wasn't altogether. It was. I would say it was partly chosen, but it was really choosing me all along.
Yeah, right. So, talk about some of the challenges and maybe pleasures of bringing Iran to life, and if you feel sort of, you know, I mean, I think it's still a part of the world that feels really inaccessible to Americans and kind of misunderstood. And, you know, we've had a little bit of a literature out there that I think Americans have been so fascinated by. But all the small details, the food, the feeling, the philosophy, the religion, everything feels, I think, so foreign to us that you'd have to approach it without being didactic, but you'd also have to really immerse us. And I'd just love for you to talk about bringing that country to life and some of the challenges and some of the fun of it.
Sure. So I think Iran has been fascinating for Americans for several decades, and I think the fascination grew out of really a very dark time, and that's the revolution and the hostage crisis. So while Iran is still unknown, it's maybe less unknown to Americans than certain other countries in the Middle East. There have been some books and some films and so forth, not always with the most kind representation of the country. So I have found that though creates a really wonderful opportunity. People are really curious. They're interested to know, particularly I'd say women are interested to know about the lives of women in Iran. And so that's created a real opportunity for me as a writer. I think that I always feel as a reader that fiction can crack open worlds for me that history books can't, or books on politics can't. A book, a novel can really give you access in a really different way. And so I hope that my book does that. I really wanted to give a sense of the lived texture of Iranian life, which was difficult because I haven't been there since I was a very little child. I was 5 years old when we came. So that exercise was a difficult one for me. I had to recreate a world that really was almost as alien to me, though it was familiar to me in certain ways because I'd grown up with my mom and my grandmother who were very, you know, Iranian to the core and had really passed on so many of the rituals and the traditions and the language too. And so it was really a difficult task, but it felt like a kind of homecoming to me. And then a gesture, I hope, of gift-giving, really, to a reader who might find they know some things about Iran, but would like to have a more nuanced and more engaging portrait of the country than they might get anywhere else.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about that research project and what that looked like. So it looked like a lot of this came kind of organically from your family through food, through language. But talk a little bit about accessing a place you haven't been. I was going to ask if you'd been back there, but it sounds like you haven't. And bringing some of those details to life, was it a lot of reading of source material, looking at pictures on the Internet? Talk about that research project.
Yeah, I would really say it was mostly, it sprung really from my reading in the period. I've I had done a PhD in Iranian women's writing, so I'd read so many books written by Iranian women, and I'd read a lot about the period, and I'd spent a decade really saturating my mind with stories and all sorts of details about the country and the lives of its women. Then for this particular project, since I'm telling the story of a poet, what was very important to me was her poetry itself. So Furukh had had several books of poetry and one published posthumously, and those were extremely important. I holed up and I read those for several months. I was just really looking at those poems and trying to pick up not just the story of who she was through the poems, but something of the quality of her mind, what her fears were, what her curiosities were, what her passions were. I mean, the poems became almost like a puzzle that I was seeking to solve, and became really, really very important part of the research in telling her life.
How much of her life was imagined versus researched? Like, where did the research... I think there was a lot about her out there, but a lot kind of inaccessible. And I'm wondering that process of taking the leap and, you know, creating a character who existed, but there's this big imagined process as well.
Right. So there wasn't... there hadn't been a book, a biography written about her for about 30 years. There's one that was really important to me, and I could not have written Song of a Captive Bird without it. But like I say, that was written 30 years ago, and it had, you know, it had done what it could at that time, but there were still so many questions I had as I was reading it. I think if I had had a more ample archive, it probably I might not have been as curious. I might not have had as many questions, and those questions might not have led me to imagine my way into the story. So there was just enough, but not too much, to overwhelm my imagination or shut it down. And so it was just the right amount of knowing and not knowing. A lot of the episodes that are pivotal in the book are actually true. They happened. Furukh had such a stunningly dramatic life. It was. I almost had to downplay certain aspects of her life because it was so extraordinary and so studded with really extraordinary events and experiences. The part that's more imagined is the story of what's happening in the country. Now, not that I imagined historical events, but I grafted this other story about a friend of hers who becomes drawn into the political unrest that rocks Iran during the 60s. And while it's imagined, that too is really drawn from the historical record. It's just in the melding of those two stories, the bringing together of Furukh's story and the second story, that is an enactment of a historical drama that I'd say is the most imaginative part of the book.
Interesting. My guest this morning is Jasmine Darznik. The book is Song of a Captive Bird. I couldn't help but think of Maya Angelou when I first saw the title of the book and the connection to poetry and what women have been, you know, regardless of what country, what age, what nationality, women sort of this tradition of women surviving through writing and surviving through poetry. And I don't know, that's such a both inspiring and sad, I think, way to tell these stories. And I'd love to hear kind of your connection to poetry. I don't know if you're a poet yourself.
Not at all, no.
Yeah, just talk about your connection to it, though.
Sure. I love poetry. I love to read poetry. I hadn't, until I encountered Furukh, I had not read a lot of Iranian poetry, because a lot of the traditional Iranian poetry felt really inaccessible to me. There was a huge chasm between spoken Persian, which is what I grew up with, and literary Persian. And also that tradition is mostly, it's mostly men, you know, honestly. And until I met Furukh, I hadn't read all that much poetry, and certainly I hadn't read much Iranian poetry in the original Persian. So she's my point of entry, really, into poetry, and she's still one of the poets I read most often, and, and I am really glad that I can read her in the original Persian, because there's certain things I think you just can't get even in a really good translation. There's a certain spirit to the poetry that is lost, I think, in translation. So Furugh is she's one of the poets that I've loved for decades, and certainly one of the really important ones to me of the Iranian poets. And I also read, you know, with great pleasure. I think of someone who is in some ways a important you know, sort of frame of reference for Furugh is Sylvia Plath. They were contemporaries, and a lot of the same themes and furies were enacted in Sylvia Plath's work. So she's been really important to me as well. But like you say, it's really both fascinating and sad that these stories are so common, that they cut across so many different geographical and historical divides.
Yeah, and that the way to fix women is to control them, to put them to call them crazy, and to call, you know. We had this big discussion at a literary event last night about difficult women, and I was thinking of Farouk, thinking what a great character she would have been in that book of famous difficult women, and the way we control them and try and silence them, and yeah, it's interesting. I'm really glad you brought up this point of bilingualism and reading in Persian, and I always think it's interesting to talk to authors who are bilingual. I don't know if maybe you're even trilingual, but I think that gives your language in English such a depth and texture and a different way of looking at things, different idioms, different metaphors. Just, you know, it just kind of turns English a little bit on its axis to write about it in a different way. And yeah. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think Persian has brought to English for you.
Interesting. You know, that's something I don't think about consciously when I'm writing, but I notice it when I look and I compare, let's say, something I've written about Iran versus something I've written about America. And when I start to write about Iran, I'm thinking in Persian, and that's lending an accent to my English. So even though I'm composing it, it's coming out sort of, you know, with a Persian accent. So the sentences are a little more sinuous. Persian is a very poetic language. It's a very beautiful, mellifluous language. And it's a little bit, I mean, Spanish has some of those same qualities. If you look at Isabel Allende's writing, she writes, of course, in Spanish, and her works are translated, but the rhythm of her sentences is really not quite the rhythm of contemporary American English. So even though I'm writing in English, I think that the Persian, since it's so deeply imprinted on me, is my first language, and then it's also the language that I'm calling on when I'm imagining Iran. You can hear it. You can hear the accent of it in my English, and hopefully it gives a depth. I think, you know, you had said it earlier.
Yes, yeah.
I think it lends a certain richness to the story, and it can really suit the subject. So writing a historical novel set in the 50s or 60s about a poet invites, I think, a certain poetic inflection or a Persian inflection in the telling.
Exactly, exactly. So let's talk about kind of the nuts and bolts of putting the book together, the structure of the book. It's told fairly linearly. It opens with a very visceral, violent, kind of hard-to-read scene. So talk about, you know, when you sat down to write the novel, if you wrote it from point A to point Z, what that was like, and kind of putting the book together, and if it, the first draft looked anywhere similar to what the last draft looked like.
Sure. No, there's so many changes. It would probably be unrecognizable even to me at this point. I wrote the book over a period of about 4 years, and it went through many, many drafts. I started out writing it in the third person, and I started writing it. It almost had the quality of a biography because I was writing it in third person, and because I also had a certain conception starting out that I needed to treat every part of Furugh's life. So there were many long sequences about her childhood, and I loved writing those. I mean, they were very heavily researched sections. But after about a year and showing it to my agent and to certain other people, there's a feeling that that's not where the story started. It was good writing, and it really hurt me to cut it and to put it. I still have it somewhere in my computer. I'm dreaming that it's gonna, that someone will want it. But it wasn't serving the story. The story didn't start with Furuk toddling around, and in her crib. The story really started
right
in her teenage years, and that's the moment where there's you revert to it. There's a rupture. There's a violent rupture between who she was and who she becomes, and that became then the true beginning of the story. And I fought that for a while, but after I made the change and let it sink in, it felt like the right change to make for the reader's sake. I also switched into first person. That was a really, that was a leap of faith initially, because you give up a lot with first person. You have this tremendous access to the interior of a character, but then that's all you ever have is that person's perspective or point of view.
Right.
But I felt that that was the right fit for this book. It really drew a reader into the story, which is what I wanted. As you were saying, Iran is unfamiliar to a lot of people, maybe alien, and so I felt something about going into the first person invited the reader more readily into the story and into the experience. So that was another tremendous change.
I wonder, just to pause there, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'm really interested in that. And if you feel like your relationship with Furuk changed when you switched points of view, because it's a really different relationship between writer and subject from third person to first person. And to get that access into her head is both exhilarating and daunting, I would think.
Of course, and she's so iconic, so there's something, audacious about making that leap into her and even creating the semblance of this this self, or presuming that I would know, right?
Yeah.
So it was a leap of faith. It was thankfully I stopped thinking about what anyone would think about it.
Particularly
people who know her and maybe have a sense of, that there might have been more boundaries there. But it was really important to me as a writer, because then I could work almost like an actor. I could step into her character, and I could access then my experiences, and I could think in this scenario, let's say, what would she have felt, and have I, all of this is happening subconsciously. It's just beneath the top of your awareness as you're working. But going into the first person really brought me closer to her, and I think that's really important for the reader in this story, is that you needed a Furuk that was close. You needed a Furuk that felt like she was speaking in your ear, and I couldn't get that through the third. I only got it when I stepped into the first person.
I've never thought of that before, but you're exactly right, that experience is being like an actor and fully inhabiting somebody. I'd never put those two things together, but that feels just right. That feels just right.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't act at all, but that's what I imagine an actor does.
Yeah, right. Me too.
And you're also drawing on, you're drawing on your empathy, and there's very little in human experience that I would say is totally unique to one person. So as writers and as artists, I think that is our task, is that we're drawing on our experience and our ability to empathize, to render experiences and lives that are not our own.
Yeah, right. So having written a memoir and fiction kind of in the same areas of concern, talk about the experience of those two different, I mean, they're different muscles, but what you must have found challenging and rewarding about each one. And I mean, it's just so interesting to me that you were, dipping into the same subject matter, but approaching it in two totally different ways. And I was wondering if one or the other felt natural, gave you things the other one didn't, whatever your observations are about that.
Sure. I was really, when I started writing, I was really so worried that I wouldn't be able to come up with a plot. I think I can write a pretty good sentence, but plot really terrifies me. So writing a memoir, in a way, that's a plot you're given, right? Though it turns out when you're writing the memoir that you're selecting it and shaping it, and it's it's not quite a plot that you've been given, but one that you're shaping as you go along. I was worried a little bit when I moved into fiction. Would I be able to sustain a book-length project that was totally made up? And in the end, it turns out that the two, the memoir and the fiction, are not that different. It's really about storytelling, and it's about character in both cases. So even though the one is called true and the other one's untrue, I really let myself be guided by the story, be guided by the character. And in both cases, place is so important. So they were landscapes that were akin or kindred to each other. Otherwise, it's so funny to me. When you write a memoir, people ask, how much of it did you make up? And then when you write a novel, people ask, how much of this is true? So
right.
I think in some ways, the memoir, it's true, but it's also imagined and therefore a story that's not entirely, the documentary truth. On the other hand, with fiction, there is a lot of me there. There's everything. I mean, all of my obsessions are in Song of a Captive Bird. The things that I'm interested about in Foodle's story tell a certain story about who I am. So the interest in motherhood, for example, or the connections between creativity and social taboo, those are all things that have really obsessed me for a really, really long time, but they're now just coming through the vehicle of fiction.
We have that conversation a lot about how much fiction can do, how much truth fiction can tell, and how much truth nonfiction can't get at. I always think
it's true.
Yeah,
it's true. And I actually had an experience where there was a story I could not tell in my memoir. It was just too painful, and I didn't include it, even though it was a really important story to me. But at the time that I was publishing The Good Daughter, I just couldn't tell it. And then when I had finished writing Song of a Captive Bird, that scene that you're talking about, the opening scene, which is about virginity and a virginity test, that was a very painful scene to write because it touched upon certain aspects of this story that I had held in reserve or was unable to tell. As I was gathering myself together for the publication of Song of a Captive Bird and thinking about Foodle's story, all of a sudden I just had the strength, or I just had the wherewithal to tell that story for the first time. And so I published it as an essay, and I think it took a long time, but something about going through Foodle's story and dealing with virginity through fiction, it unlocked something in me, and it made it possible for me then to go back and to tell the story in an essay form that had eluded me for years and years, or that I had blocked for years and years.
I do think that's one of the big powers of fiction, that it gives you a little bit of internal license. And it is interesting to look at people's works of fiction and see how biographical it is. And sometimes totally subconsciously that, you reveal yourself without knowing you're revealing yourself in a thousand ways. And that's really interesting. Oh, we're drawing down on our time. Do you have, having come through the process of both fiction and memoir, advice for writers, things that sustain you over the 4 years that you worked on this, or little lessons that you gleaned that are that people can claw onto?
Sure. Claw on is a great term, because I'm thinking you just have to be so dogged. You have to be so persistent with yourself too, all the moments that you're almost giving up, and then all the discouraging or maybe not quite encouraging things that people will tell you along the way. With both books, there were many, many times where I almost shut the project down. So I think you just have to cultivate a certain, fanatical belief in yourself and your writing. And if part of that can be thinking, what am I in service to? So I want to write this book because I want to be published, but also thinking about, what are the bigger stakes for you? Are you telling a story, for example, about a place, as for me, Iran, that people don't know about, and you want to write a story that's going to humanize that place or make it alive or make it more interesting? So that can be really very powerful. It has been for me to think about the bigger stakes in what you're you're doing. And other than that, I think reading is so important. I think that that's you're really tuning your instrument by reading really excellent work. I think you're priming your mind, and then when you write your own work, I think then it comes out far richer if you've spent time reading really excellent work. It's going to show in yours too.
Yeah, and reading outside your comfort zone, I think, is good.
Yeah, reading everything. I read really broadly. I didn't start writing until I was in my early or mid-30s, and yet I got going quicker because I had been reading so much and so much that was different for many, many years. So that helped me a lot, and I've never stopped that.
Yeah, great advice, great advice. Jasmine Darznik, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much.
That was Jasmine Darznik. The book, Song of a Captive Bird, is out and available now. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Tara Westover will be with me for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, events, and more. The show is turning 20 next month. I can't believe it. So if you do the math, two authors a week for 20 years, you can imagine how many interviews are up there and available for your listening pleasure. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Tara Westover was born in Idaho in 1986. She received her BA from BYU in 2008 and was subsequently awarded a Gates Cambridge scholarship. She earned her MPhil from Trinity College in Cambridge in 2009, and in 2010 was a visiting fellow at Harvard. She returned to Cambridge, where she was awarded a PhD in history in 2014. Educated, a Memoir is her first book. It's published by Random House. With that introduction, you won't believe if you haven't heard how Tara came to all of those places. So we're going to hear all about that. Tara, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks. So, such a remarkable story. I first heard you on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and then I immediately ran out and bought the book and kind of followed you on the New York Times after that. So it's funny because while your story is just incredible, I think it's also feels like it's tapping into something in people it's obviously not universal because your story is very specific and unusual, but something visceral that people are really connecting to. So I want to talk about all of that. But first, for listeners who aren't yet familiar with you in the book, kind of give us a scope of the story, kind of the broad brush strokes of where you were and how you came to be.
Yeah, so I was raised the youngest of seven children on a really beautiful mountain in southern Idaho. But my father was something of a charismatic radical, and what that meant was that he was opposed to a lot of the institutions that most people take for granted. So doctors and hospitals, public education, really anything to do with the government. And so I was never put in school as a child, and I was never taken to the doctor, not even when I was ill or if me and my siblings were injured working in my dad's junkyard, we were not taken to the doctor. And then I didn't even have a birth certificate. So what that meant was, I got my birth certificate when I was nine. And what that meant was that according to the state of Idaho and the federal government, I just didn't exist.
Yeah, amazing. So, and then you sort of clawed your way out and into the university system, which was against his wishes. And So talk a little bit about it. As I was reading this, I was sort of thinking about the purpose of memoir and what memoir is doing, especially in sort of today's tumultuous world. And I feel like, it's bringing us to a closer understanding of another person's point of view. And then I thought, what a great book this is for kind of this time in our history to get intimate access to a perspective we may not know exists or we may not understand, and to bring empathy and kind of a look inside the lives of others, which is good for all of us. And then I started wondering about your motivations for, was the memoir a tool for you to understand what happened to you, or was it a tool for you to help others understand you know, another perspective, or kind of tell me the motivation about writing the book.
I think it was helpful for me to understand, but I didn't necessarily think that it would be. When I was first thinking about writing the book, you know, I'd been on this pretty intense journey of education. I'd never been allowed to go to school, and then I had ended up getting a PhD from Cambridge and going to Harvard. But that path of education that I was put on would actually take me away from my family, and a bunch of dramatic events that I would be disowned, I would be ostracized from my family. And when I was going through that process of losing them, I just became very sensitive to the stories that I was exposed to, whether it was in film or in novels or even advertising. And I became aware of the really important role that stories play in our lives. It seemed to me that what they really do is they tell us how we're supposed to feel, when we're supposed to feel proud, when we're supposed to feel ashamed. And I was going through this incredibly difficult experience of losing my parents, of losing some members of my family. And I just didn't feel like there were stories for that. I didn't know how I was supposed to feel and how I was supposed to navigate that. And for a while, I did consider writing the story as a novel. But then it seemed to me, I mean, what I really wanted, what I craved the most was kind of someone to stand up and say, this happened to me. You know, I think I had a lot of shame and a lot of guilt that I couldn't fix things with my family, that I couldn't make it better. It felt like I should be able to. And after I had a little bit of perspective on it a few years later, I thought, no, I think what would have helped me the most going through that was to have someone else be willing to stand up and say, this happened to me.
Do you feel like you're early? I mean, you didn't go through a formal education system, but you feel very well prepared for the very structured, formal higher educational system. Do you feel like there were parts of your childhood that particularly prepared you in a unique way to face some of the...
In a way, I wasn't that prepared. I mean, one of my first lectures I went to when I was at college, I raised my hand and asked what the Holocaust was because I'd never heard of it. And I think the other students thought that I was being anti-Semitic, that I was denying it, but it wasn't. I just didn't know what it was. So in some ways, I was really not prepared because I had never written an essay. I'd never taken an exam. My mother had never gotten us together and delivered lectures or anything like that. So I had no formal education, almost none. But I think what I was taught by my family that I did appreciate, my family had this philosophy that you can teach yourself anything better than someone else can teach it to you. And so my conception of education was that I could learn things, that I could learn it, you know, for myself. And I am grateful to them that they gave me that. I think it was almost never more relevant than when I started trying to learn how to write, actually.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too. Well, they also taught you grit, I would imagine, just from reading.
Yeah, they did. They definitely did.
Perseverance, grit, yeah, yeah. So I had heard of a pretty interesting interview that you really didn't delve into the writing world until you kind of sat down to write this memoir. And that process, I think, is really interesting. Teaching yourself not only, you know, all of the formal education stuff, but teaching yourself how to write, how to put together a book, how to kind of create a narrative arc out of material. And I don't know... what was the most instrumental to you in knowing how to write a book, but it's remarkable. And I think you did it in, like, not that long over a period of time.
Well, I hadn't read that many novels, I realized. So I, you know, because I'd never set foot in a classroom when I was 17. I was really behind my peers. So for the 10 years that followed, I was just reading academic books. I was reading history books. I was trying to catch up. I was trying to, you know, become competent academically. And when I finished my PhD and decided I would try to write this story, I realized I had read a handful of novels, but really not very many, and nothing recent. You know, I'd read Dickens or something. So I sort of thought, well, I don't really have what I need to write. So I remember trying to Google, you know, narrative arc and try to figure out what it was, and that didn't yield very much. And then I heard a friend talking about this thing called short stories, and I thought, well, that sounds great, because I read a lot of those, I can get a grip on what narrative arc is, and they're shorter, so I can get through a great number. And then from there I started listening to the New Yorker Fiction podcast, which for me just became the textbook of writing, because what that podcast is writers reading short stories by other writers and then discussing them with the fiction editor.
Uh-huh.
And so I loved it. In terms of, you know, self-teaching, it was an amazing instrument because you could pick stories that you loved. You know, so I didn't have to spend a lot of time studying stories that I didn't love. I could pick a writer who I really loved. And then these two very, you know, talented writers, very clever writers, would go through and explain how everything worked. And I didn't understand tenseness. I didn't understand point of view. I didn't understand anything. But then after they had explained it to me, I began to be able to see those things myself. And then eventually I was able to use them.
And tell me a little bit about structuring the book. I mean, I imagine, you know, 100,000 things happen to you. And so picking those pivotal points to tell the story, well, you know, did you have sort of 1,000 other things that didn't make it into the book that could have?
Yeah, I think everybody, I think anytime you write a memoir, although I don't know, sometimes I think that when memoir goes wrong, it's from over-remembering and maybe putting too much in. Mm. So I felt like what was hard to learn how to do with writing the memoir was just learning how to clear everything away, because it's your life, and so it feels like everything is connected, like there are all these cleavages, and you know the history of the salad bowl that was at the dinner table that your mother gave that to your aunt before she had cancer. Like, you know all of this, and it's really tempting to put it all in there. And I think probably what I had to learn was the ability to clear it all away and try to get hold of what the story was about. So I wrote a lot of chapters that were just, I would get to the end of writing them and I just didn't really know what they were about or why I'd written them. And it took me a while to get hold of a story.
One of the really gripping parts of this is memory and the unreliability of memory. You have a lot of footnotes in here about I remembered it this way and my brothers remembered it that way. And you had an abusive brother who really, his psychological hold over you, you can talk about this better than I, was changing your memories, changing how you perceived what was going on. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the reliability of memory and having written the book, how you feel about the kind of events that happened to you in light of, you know, in light of remembering them versus talking to family about them and kind of just the malleability of memory.
Yeah, so I had all of these journal entries, which really helped me because I had written a lot of this stuff down at the time. Another thing that was helpful was being able to talk to my siblings. But, you know, in terms of the kind of violent episodes with my brother, that was very tricky because, you know, I have a theory that I think all abuse, no matter what kind of abuse it is foremost an assault on the mind. And I think if you're going to abuse someone, you have to invade the reality and you have to distort it. And my brother was very good at that. He could kind of convince me within a few minutes that something I thought had happened had actually not happened, or that I'd misunderstood it, or that, you know, he would say it had just been a game and that we'd been having fun. And so there were a lot of entries that I had where I wasn't sure. I would kind of write what happened, and I would say, oh, maybe it was just a game. But there were a few that I didn't do that with. And so I had some kind of independent in the moment, you know, I'm a historian, like literal historical sourcing that was really helpful. And then being able to talk to other people who'd experienced the same thing or who'd seen bits, you know, some of the times that my brother would attack me like that, there were other people around, and so I could ask them what they had seen. And, you know, it was a process of reconciling and of trying to put it together. But I think, I mean, a lot of the book is about, it is about that term gaslighting, and which is, you know, when other people deny things that are happening, because that would ultimately be what would cause the estrangement between me and my family. I would confront my parents about my brother's violence, and then they would ostracize me for that. They would disown me for that. So a lot of the book is about who gets to tell other people's stories and whose reality gets to be absolute, because I don't necessarily claim my reality is absolute, but I did write the book as kind of an affirmation of my own right to have my own memories and not just yield my own reality to my parents' interpretation of my brother's behavior. But that was a negotiation with my journals, with my memories, with other people who were there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to sort of set out to be a researcher or, you know, an archaeologist of your own life and looking back over experiences and digging through it and you know, thank God you have journal. This is such a testament to journal keeping, I think. I don't know if.
Yeah, I don't know what I would do without them, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Do you still journal?
I write occasionally, but not the way I did when I was little. I mean, I have like 20 of these journals that from when I was 10 going all through my PhD, and for writing a book, I mean, it's unbelievably useful because there's so much I wouldn't have remembered.
Right.
And
right.
Talking to my brothers helped as well. They seem to have pretty good memories.
Yeah.
Pretty detailed memories.
Did the act of writing this book change your perception of anything? Like, did it reveal things to you that you, I mean, it sounds like it brought up memories that you didn't necessarily remember that you had, but did it kind of solidify a point of view, or did it change your point of view on certain things?
It did, kind of. I think in some ways it gave me more empathy for my parents, especially my dad, because, I mean, he's the one who made this decision to kind of ostracize me when I came forward about my brother, and there were a lot of years I was just angry about that, and I still have moments when I'm angry about that. But I think writing the book and putting it all together, one thing that became clear to me, or at least a hypothesis I developed, was that he was kind of mentally ill. And I'd thought that before, and it's, you know, I'm not a medical professional, so I can't say for certain, but I often have thought that his paranoia about the government, his paranoia about public education, about doctors and hospitals, really is just best explained by some kind of mood disorder. And I've thought that for a long time, but it really wasn't until I was writing and kind of remembering things that he said and the decisions that he made about, you know, even his own health. When he was working in the scrapyard once, he was standing next to a car when the car exploded, and he was burned terribly. Because he's my dad, they, you know, he decided not to go to the hospital, and they treated this really severe burn that he had in his whole upper body just with herbs, with a salve my mother made. And kind of really thinking about events like that kind of helped me understand my dad a bit more and kind of realize, yeah, it's not that he didn't really care about our well-being. You know, he didn't deny us medical care because he didn't care about us. These were deeply held beliefs that he had.
It's interesting to look at events from a kid's point of view trying to make sense of it and from an adult's point of view trying to make sense of it. And I always feel like that adults write about childhood so much because it was a pre-language time of life, or, you know, you didn't have all of the context to give something. You wouldn't have known that your dad was mentally ill. And so you're always trying to go back and make sense of all that stuff that you had as a kid, or you witnessed as a kid. And
yeah,
writing is
well, I feel like there's sometimes you just don't have all the information that you need to understand what's happening to you. So my dad's junkyard was this incredibly dangerous place because he just didn't take safety precautions. I mean, the reason that car exploded when he was standing next to it is because he had a cutting torch and he was trying to take the fuel tank off, but he hadn't punctured the tank and drained the fuel, which anybody would have done. So he didn't really seem able to understand risk or to understand the consequences of risk taking. He always seemed to believe that God wouldn't allow anything bad to happen. And so, you know, we would get injured in the scrapyard all the time because he just didn't take proper, you know, we weren't allowed to wear safety harnesses, we weren't allowed to wear hard hats. And I think as a child, you don't really know how to interpret what's happening to you because, you know, I knew that my dad loved me. And so if he asked me to do something and I got really hurt doing it, I either had to blame myself and say, well, why couldn't I do this? It was simple. Or I had to think maybe he didn't love me. And I think both of those can be, you know, just very difficult emotionally. But I think now I'm older, I understand this other category, this other explanation, you know, and that's just a bit of information I didn't have the first time I was going through it. I didn't understand mental illness. I didn't know what that meant. And so it was useful for me to go through and maybe experience those things again with a better understanding of what was happening.
There's so many embedded metaphors in this book. You know, you have the beauty of nature and the mountain and all the rugged beauty of Idaho juxtaposed with this industrial metal junkyard that's dangerous. So you've got, you know, your dad, who probably is very empathetic, full of love for you, but dangerous and the metaphors seem sort of built into the landscape of this book, which I guess is just a happy circumstance. I mean, that's just how it happened. But what a gift.
Yeah, it's funny, though, how you have to try to think of them, though. I mean, I've written a good chunk of the book before I remembered the story that my dad had told me. You know, I grew up on this mountain, and my dad had always told me this story about, he called her the Indian princess. If you stood back from the mountain and looked up in the spring, you could see the impression of a woman's body on the mountain face. And she had kind of, her legs were the ravines, and her hair was a spray of pine trees that found out over the northern ridge. My dad had told us that the nomadic Indians used to watch for her coming as a sign of spring, that winter was over, the mountain was thawing, and it was time to come home. It was this beautiful story that he told us about how the princess would appear in the spring. And I was writing a book about my own journey away and my own longing to come back. And I'd written a serious chunk of the book before I remembered that and thought, that really is the perfect metaphor for so much that's in the book. But, you know, it just hadn't occurred to me.
I think the subconscious mind does so much work that we're not even aware of as writers, that especially in a book like this, that all of that stuff is embedded in you, and just the act of writing it, you might not even be aware that you're calling all that stuff out, but it's there, right? And
yeah, sometimes. I'm sure there was a lot that came out unconsciously. Definitely that particular metaphor, I had to really think it out. And you know, ultimately that's what I would choose to open the book with, because I decided it was just the exact right image. But I don't know why it took me a lot of the book to kind of, I think it took me that long to realize what I was writing about, exactly what the story was, and then to kind of put together that this was a good metaphor for it.
Yeah, right, right. I do think you kind of have to get the bulk of the thing out to figure out what it is you're writing about, and then carve away, you know, like the mountain. You've got to carve away all the stuff that isn't David. You've got to get out of there, you know. And
yeah, I think a lot of writing is just editing. I've always felt like the chapters that I have that work the best are the ones that I've taken everything out that doesn't belong there. And I find sometimes I've had chapters that they've been made so much better by taking out a scene that just had the wrong atmosphere. That just, like, you're building something and you have a certain momentum and you have an atmosphere created, and then you have something that just doesn't belong, and it can really derail the whole thing. And it's sometimes hard to kind of figure out what's gone wrong with a chapter. But I had a lot of chapters that I thought were just not working, and then I took a scene out and then they did.
Yeah, isn't that funny? We're drawing down on our time, but you had wonderful advice on the New Yorker fiction podcast. I'm wondering if there are other things along the way that served you writing advice wise for people working on memoir, people working on short stories, fiction, writing advice that really helped, because your learning curve was very fast and steep, and you pulled this off so beautifully.
Thank you. I've always thought that people are told to read really widely. And, you know, after I got my agent, she once said to me, you must read so many books. And I said to her, no, I don't read very many books. I read the same books many times, which is true for me. And again, I think everybody's different, so what will work for one person might not work for someone else. But I feel like repetition for me is a lot, like, depth over breadth, and I feel like I can't really understand what a story is doing or a book is doing until I've read it several times, and so and kind of taking it apart and figuring out why certain scenes work and why certain things are put where they are. So I've been a big fan of reading less, but reading it over and over until you really have a command of it.
Are you leaving writing behind now that you've written this book and going on to other pursuits, or is writing now kind of in your blood and there'll be more?
I think I might keep trying, but I don't know. I mean, right now all I do is promote the book, and right. Hilary Mantel in the UK has said that she thinks writing a book and promoting a book are completely different activities, and as near as I can tell, that's true. I just cannot imagine a life less conducive to writing than the one I'm living right now.
It is funny, you know, I mean, writers are generally introverts, and then there's this whole other side where they have to promote the book, and it's so antithetical
so
to yeah, everything that they know to be true. But well, congratulations. This is masterful and fascinating to read.
Thank you.
So thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. That was Tara Westover. The book is Educated. It is out and available now. Fascinating, fascinating read. That is all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you. I think Barbara, actually, will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.